Episode 11, Deb Wirtz.
Knowing in advance what works for you, what I like to say, what sings to you, is important. And when you can identify those things, you can look forward to starting this.
You're listening to the Taylor Fit Wellness Podcast, where we explore wellness topics from A to Z so that we can take an active approach to improving our quality of life. So I am so excited to have Deb Wirtz on our show. Good to see you, Deb.
Good to see you, Frances. I'm happy to be here.
I'm so grateful to have another connection with a kindred spirit, and I'm so excited for our conversation today.
Me too.
So I would love it if you could tell us a little bit more about yourself.
I'm going to talk a little bit about my yoga journey to start, since that's one of our common threads.
Yeah.
Yoga really found me. I remember being a kid and my grandfather had all these books about all these different subjects and he had a yoga book. I don't know why, because he never did yoga. And it had all these pictures and I remember looking and seeing cobra pose and whatever, and being fascinated by this book whenever I would go over and stay with them. And I had no idea why. And shelve that and fast forward into my 20s, I always wanted to do yoga and never knew why. And I finally took a class in the gym and liked the practice, but was underwhelmed with the teacher. And then I shelved it when I had kids. And it found me again afterwards. My husband had bought me some videos. I think he wanted me to lose the baby weight. And they were like power yoga type of things. It was Baron Baptiste. And that's, to me, I'm a very type A personality. And you want to talk about somebody who needed yoga. I did. And it gave me the ability to do yoga, but feel like I was exercising at the same time. And that was really my initial goal.
Great.
And then it wasn't until I started looking for a studio to practice in that was a whole different animal. It wasn't just about the workout. It was about, well, let's sit and breathe and let's chant Om. And suddenly I started to notice that, wow, I feel a lot more calm. I was able to go into situations and not flip out if things didn't go my way. And I'm like, who am I? Who is this person? You know, those extra benefits really found me by accident. Well, not so by accident, by design, of course. And it was a long time. I practiced for a long time. I went back to college after I had my kids and finished up my math degrees. You know, that's the way the world works. We don't work at the same place for 30 years and get the gold watch when we retire at 65. That world is dead. You know that.
That's no longer a world that we live in. Right. I actually got it, being in the fitness industry, I actually got a gift like that once. I worked at one place for 10 years and I was so excited I'd never expected to get anything for working somewhere, but they gave us a catalog to choose our own gift. And I remember choosing this pendant that it was beautiful. And I wore that with pride because I felt like no matter, you know, it was just so great to feel appreciated. And it was a symbol of appreciation that I got to wear with pride and kind of know in my heart, like I've been working here for a long time. And, yeah, and it's,
that your
it's
hard
a shame
work was rewarded.
My hard work was rewarded, you know, as you know, and I think in a lot of times it's hard to feel that appreciation in other areas. In parenting is like one you mentioned parenting.
The thankless job.
The thankless job. The mom, you know, mom does a lot of stuff that doesn't get appreciated. And
there's no pay.
Correct.
All the chauffeuring that you do. And
Yeah. We wear a lot of hats. So, yeah, so I, especially as a mom, when I wore that little pendant, I was like, I am appreciated, you know, like it was kind of a good little badge for a while. So, yeah.
And so my industry dried up after I had kids where I worked. I was in tech support in the paging industry of all things. And I went back to school after I had kids to get back into the workforce.
Yeah.
And in the meantime, I kept doing yoga to keep me sane while I was going to school and having little kids, raising a family. And it wasn't until there was some point I had been a personal trainer, actually, back in my 20s and an aerobics instructor. I did step. I love all those things.
Yeah, and another connection. I'm a personal trainer as well. Yes.
There you go.
God.
And I wanted to become a yoga teacher, but I couldn't go to yoga teacher training. And
Yeah.
you know, I didn't want to go to yoga teacher training and be in college at the same time. I think I would have hit tilt.
Oh, no.
But, and also it was expensive. I wasn't sure how I was going to make the money work. But it's funny, I'm a big believer in the universe always provides.
Okay.
And it was funny because I was going to graduate in May of 2009. And in like February, it was announced that a place where I was going in New York City, I knew I wanted to study with Dharma Mitra. And do you know him? Are you familiar with him?
Yes.
Okay. And he was going to have a teacher training in June of 2009.
Yes.
And it was funny because it was like right after school ended and I was able to make the time and I had scraped together the money and I'm like, oh wow, this is all working out. I'm going to have to spend 10 days in the city because it was a 10-day intensive training.
Yeah.
And I'm going to have to get a hotel room. And okay, that's more money. And 2 days later, my now ex-husband said, oh, I did our taxes and we're we got a refund. So here's your portion of it. And it was like within like $50 of what the hotel was going to cost.
How about that? Isn't that perfect? How do things work out? I'm wondering a little bit. You and I know Dharma Mitra, but maybe explain a little bit more about what drew you to that practice. Like, why was it that teacher training that you did? And in that way, then our listeners can learn a little bit more about Dharma Mitra as well.
All right. What he provides is everybody knows about Hatha Yoga. They know the term, but a lot of people don't know what the term means. And if you know about the eight limbs of yoga, the first four limbs are about the physical and the last four limbs are more about like the metaphysical, the mind and whatnot. That's where meditation and concentration, the things that lead up to meditation are. And so a lot of practices are physical or about the physical, and that's the Hatha. And then the last four is what's called the Raja. And what he does is he builds the Raja. His practice is, he calls it a Hatha Raja practice because he builds the meditation and all of that into the asana practice, the physical practice. And so you learn how to meditate within each of the postures and how to get out of your mind.
Oh my God, that's so perfect. Especially if your mind tends to race or if you are an A type, as you mentioned, like to be able to zero in and find a way to be calm within that.
Exactly, because we can sit and meditate, and we'll talk about meditation later, but it's one thing to sit for 15 minutes a day on the mat and the mind tends to wander, and that's all part of the process, but to be able to meditate perpetually, to be able I don't want to say control the thoughts, but to be able to manage the thoughts is a huge tool that I think everybody can benefit from.
You know, I kind of think of it like a fork in the road. Can I tell you a secret?
Of course. Do tell.
Okay. So I was a little preoccupied yesterday and I found near our home, there's a trail in the woods and I've done it a couple times, but I was preoccupied. I was on the phone. I was having an intense conversation and before long, I was completely lost in the woods.
Oh, no.
Just yesterday. And so I'm thinking about like the meditation process, like when I was lost yesterday and then I had to find my way back. And yes, there was a GPS and I was able to find it, but I was a little, again, distracted. And at first it took me a little bit, you know, even after I asked someone with social distancing, you know, which way is it to get back to my neighborhood? As soon as they told me where to go, you know, I went where I thought they had said, and then there was immediate fork in the road. And I was like, well, now which way? You know, I just asked someone, now they're gone. Now there's a fork in the road. And she said, go uphill. That was my task. Just go uphill. Like, you'll see it. And when I went to, you know, just turn the corner and I looked and both directions seemed uphill to me. So I'm like, okay, now which way is it? Mm-hmm. And so in thinking in the meditation practice that we can be distracted by thoughts, we can be overwhelmed by things. And in the middle of our internal awareness, there's a fork in the road, and then we have a choice. Mm-hmm. We can go and follow the crazy thought. We can get more distraught, or maybe we can bring it back a little bit, and we can make a choice to acknowledge the thought, let it go, come back to the breath or the focal point, mm-hmm. numbers, passage meditation. There's a lot of different ways to go about it, and we'll talk a bit more about that in a little bit. But yeah, it's just kind of a funny story I thought I would share. Like, when you're lost in the woods, what do? When you're lost in your internal thoughts, what do? And maybe meditation can help us with that. What do you think?
Absolutely, because I believe that when you learn how to quiet the mind, and quiet the mind and clear the mind are two different things. You learn to prioritize. It's like when you can push all of those, oh my God, what do? I'm lost. I'm never going to get out of here. All the you know, how the mind spirals. Yeah. I'll be here forever. I'm going to starve. when you can push those thoughts to the background, then there's a quiet. And then there are always guideposts. And maybe you experienced that when you found that fork in the road, when you quieted the mind, that one path became more clear than the other, because there were things that were more subtle, that because maybe one was more uphill than the other one. Yeah. And then you knew which way to go. Was that what happened?
I just had to pause long enough to get out of my kind of stressed state, because I was still on the phone with the other person, granted, and so it was a choice. Do I keep walking? And I'm lost. Do I keep walking while I'm lost and on the phone? Or do I pause and say, look, let me call you back. I need to stop. Mm-hmm. I need to back up. I need to look at the GPS, because we have those tools, right? I mean, we have those tools now, right? Mm-hmm. I'm not going to be lost in the woods. I know that on an intellectual level. However, the visceral level, like in my body, I'm like still in that panic. Not the monkey mind. What is it? The lizard brain, mm-hmm. like where your instincts kick in.
Right.
We have all these animals that we associate with the mind, monkey mind, lizard brain, right? But, you know, I had to pause, and I had to, I guess, get out of my monkey mind first, get off the phone, mm-hmm. get out of my lizard brain where I was in a panic, and just pause and calm down.
Exactly.
And then, you know,
because if you hadn't done those,
tool.
Yeah, if you hadn't done those things, maybe you wouldn't have thought to use the GPS.
Yeah, that's right.
I had somebody who said, who called me and said, I'm on my way to your house, but I lost about a half an hour because I had locked my keys in the house and I had to break into my own house. And I said, but didn't you tell me you have a spare key and he's like, oh, I totally forgot I had a spare key to my own house.
Oh my God. He reminded me of me and my girlfriend coming back from a trip and breaking into her house. I think it was me that had to crawl in through the dog door to get into her house. My good friend, she got a picture of like my feet out of the, you know, sticking out of the dog door. Oh my God. Breaking into your own house. That's a whole nother topic all in itself.
Yeah. That's another podcast.
Yeah, it is.
The GPS was the tool that you realized that you had once you quieted your mind.
Exactly. Sometimes, even though it's right there, we won't see it if we're in a state of confusion. So we had to pause, step back. And maybe this is a little bit more along the lines of the difference between clearing and calming the mind. Mm-hmm. Do you know the story with Thich Nhat Hanh and the apple juice?
Oh, I don't know. Refresh my memory.
So this was a story of Thich Nhat Hanh, who is a meditation teacher, spiritual teacher.
Yes. Wonderful.
Many, many books.
Love him.
Lots of information and very simple, peaceful practice. The story goes, so he has a place, Plum Village in France.
Yes.
My partner at the time and I had just taken a trip through part of France and then Italy as well. We got to visit Plum Village briefly, and I remember hearing the story and just having this image in my mind of Thich Nhat Hanh. And the story is that Thich Nhat Hanh in Plum Village, children are welcome. Like there's like children there. And the story goes that, you know, Thich Nhat Hanh was sitting at a picnic table and there was a child there with apple juice. And the analogy is, you know, what is meditation? And this is Thich Nhat Hanh talking to the child. I think maybe the child asked, what is meditation? And Thich Nhat Hanh said, well, take this apple juice, for example. And it was like the sort of natural kind of apple juice that has sediment in it. Mm. And then, you know, you stir it up if you stir it up, then the sediment is sort of swirling around. But then if you stop, then that sediment starts to settle. And that settling is an analogy for what happens in meditation.
That's a great story. I had never heard that before. I use the I use a snow globe when I talk about it, and how we kind of shake things up during the physical practice. Yes. And then during Shavasana, we let everything sit, and the snow just settles in a slightly different, more ordered place. Like, not like in a snow globe, it's random, but really we start to put the pieces together when during the practice we question our beliefs.
Okay.
And yeah, it's very similar to that. I like that idea of the apple juice.
It's good, right? I love the snow globe analogy. So let's see. I think I interrupted you because you were telling us about where you're coming from.
Right.
Tell us a little more.
We started to talk about Dharma. And so I did take the practice and I started teaching, and the opportunity came along the place where I was teaching. The woman had kind of lost interest in the business. Her life changed, as things do. She got divorced. She was working full time now, and she was ready to sell the practice. I had the opportunity. I'm a businesswoman at heart, and I bought the practice.
Beautiful.
I love that. I had the studio for about 5 years, and I really have a lot of fond memories of it. And one of the things that I developed during that time was a practice to help people use yoga and meditation to heal panic attacks.
Oh, wow.
And that was actually a very successful program.
Oh, great. Good, good, good.
Yeah.
Wow. So was that a workshop you did at the studio then?
Yes. I still offer it over the phone, but eventually I'll make that an online course.
Oh, that's a great thing. I think that will be such a good tool for a lot of people, to help a lot of people. That's so
good.
Yeah,
the people that took the course really had a lot of benefits from it.
That's another connection we have, having a yoga studio.
Yes.
And then I used to get all excited about the workshops and planning them and figuring out like what might be fun for people and what might be most beneficial. Mm-hmm. I had a series that I did for a while. It was called, because I teach Pilates too, so the series was Pilates Moves for Yoga Grooves.
Nice.
And the grooves were supposed to be the pathways that we sort of like ingrain, you know, through habit, the samskaras,
mm-hmm.
right? So to try to, if there's a pathway that you've created that is maybe not a great alignment for you, how do you kind of reshape that and remold that? So the idea of mixing the Pilates with the yoga was to try to help you with alignment issues. So
right. That's
kind of exciting. Yeah.
Yeah.
What did you guys do did you do teacher trainings?
No, that's something that I never really got into. I feel that I started to work with somebody else to maybe put a teaching school together. Mm-hmm. I feel like we could have offered a lot, but it's hard because Yoga Alliance has made it that anybody can have a teacher training. And sometimes I feel like studios do that to stay afloat.
Yeah.
Well, at least in my area, like I'm on Long Island in New York.
Yeah.
And I feel like a lot of the studios, if they're picking up teacher trainings for the wrong reasons, and I didn't want to start. And there are so many yoga teachers out there right now. And some of them are young and don't really have a solid practice behind them. And then they're out teaching other people.
Yeah. Honorable of you, Deb. I think that the talk in the industry was a little bit like people are cranking out yoga teachers. Like there's like a yoga teacher making machine,
mm-hmm,
you know?
Exactly.
So what you're talking about is, and then there's flooding the market with like all of these yoga teachers with very little experience. Like maybe they're very athletic, but then what experience do they have? And
yeah. It's
interesting. That's very honorable of you. I appreciate that, you know, to take the care and the time to realize that, this shouldn't be such a quick fix. And for a lot of studios, it is what probably kept them afloat, and because it's a moneymaker, right?
Mm-hmm.
Teaching yoga teacher training. But what's behind it, I think, if you want to do the right thing, you want to have a good, solid teacher training that covers all of those limbs, right, that you were talking about.
And I wouldn't necessarily want to just have everybody like that applies come in just because it's lining my own pockets.
Yeah. Yeah, of course.
Yeah. Because then again, it's a reflection on me ultimately, if that person goes out and somebody gets hurt or they don't have the experience and they go and they present themselves in a way that maybe isn't indicative of really what their skills are.
Yeah, yeah.
And something that I appreciate as someone in, I'm in my 50s, and when I really started teaching a lot of classes when I had the studio, because that's what happens.
That's what happens. You teach like a lot of classes when you have a studio. You're like the main teacher, and then you fill in, right, with other people.
Exactly. And the people leave, and you have to pick up their classes until you find somebody else.
Yes.
But and one of the things that I learned is that not everybody is 20 and limber and putting their leg behind their head and jumping up into handstands, and they're happy that they can just sit on the floor comfortably.
Yeah, there's a whole group.
Right. And they're healing injuries. I've dealt with a lot of runners. And I think there's a whole thing. It's one thing to say, oh, I know how to put a sequence together, but it's a whole different thing to be able to teach someone how to modify their practice for having tight hips, having had knee surgery, and, you know, shoulder issues and things. And
name it. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. We did specialty classes dealing with a different sort of body parts, like it was called the Happy Healthy series. So Happy Healthy Shoulders and Happy Healthy Knees were the two classes that just like sold out. We actually overbooked the shoulder class. It was one of the first workshops we did at the studio, and literally we had the mats lined out ahead of time so that, because we packed the studio and with our booking system, someone booked their space and maybe didn't confirm or something like that. So we had actually an extra person besides the mats that we had laid out mat to mat, and we didn't know who was in and who wasn't. So we somehow made that work. I don't know how, but that was the shoulder class. So shoulders, big topic for issues, and knees too.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah. And then that's all. And the knees and the hips are important factors in a meditation practice.
Yes.
And I think that's what keeps some people from having a meditation practice, is because they think they need to be sitting in lotus on the floor in order to meditate.
Right. Yeah. And which is not so, right?
Not at all.
What would you say the main things are that are important in your seated position with regard to a meditation practice?
I think a straight spine is more important than anything else.
Right, right.
You know, if for one thing, to align the chakras, but really for proper breath, to be able to expand the lungs.
Yeah, right. So to create those natural curves in the spine, right, the lumbar curve, right, and then the thoracic curve and the cervical curve. So elongated curves. See, I'm trying to sit up straight now. So
I know, right? Me too.
So elongating the spine, aligning the head over the rib cage, over the pelvis.
Mm-hmm. Exactly. That's more important than anything. And that can be done in a straight back chair.
Yeah, right? Isn't that good?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So we talked about a couple of things, Deb, before we started to record. And I wonder if maybe you want to kind of give us some insight into the few things that we talked about with regard to meditation. Like the couple of things we talked about: starting a practice, the expectation of results, and staying on track. Do you want to speak a little bit more about what it means to start a practice, or how you would start it, or what would you say about starting a practice?
Starting a practice, I think what's the most important is consistency, because it's actually better to meditate every day or mostly every day for a short period of time than it is to meditate for 15 minutes and then the next day saying, oh, I don't have time to meditate for 15 minutes. I'm going to miss my train, and then not meditate again for 3 months.
Okay.
And that could be for something as short as 3 minutes, to just meditate for 1 minute, because you and I both know that it's very difficult to tame the mind. To sit there for 15 minutes and to have your mind off on a tangent and you don't even realize it is not productive. Whereas if you just do it for a short amount of time for 3 minutes, and then at first, even in 3 minutes, you're not going to catch the mind wandering, and that's okay. And I'm starting to probably ease into the expectations, because the expectations I think that a lot of people have are that I should sit down, clear my mind, and have it be empty. And if I can't do that, well, then I suck at meditation, or I can't do meditation. This is what so many people have told me.
I hear you. I wonder if we might come back a little bit to this idea of consistency. So With regard to consistency being one important thing mm-hmm. with regard to meditation, what would make the possibility of consistency happen? Doing it on a regular basis.
The one main thing is, or one of the main things is having a dedicated space. And it doesn't have to be anything fancy. It could just be a chair that you have, if you're sitting in a chair, it could just be a chair that's free, that the dry cleaning isn't on, that there aren't like the kids' toys, magazines that you're going to read someday.
Yeah.
Or having a space on the floor or a place that you could just quickly pull out a meditation cushion. But something that the less effort that you have to put in to starting is going to be the key to consistency. That's because as soon as you have to start doing something to prepare the space or doing anything substantial, you're going to just blow it off. Like, oh, I don't have time for this. This is, you know,
you
like,
want the
I'm going to spend 10 minutes to set up a space to meditate for a minute.
Right. And you want the barrier to your practice to be as low as possible. So like make there be no barriers to your practice. Like I mm-hmm. think runners, sometimes I've heard people say, just roll out of bed, stick your shoes on and go. Like that's the way to make it happen. So if you think mm-hmm. about meditation, to make the barrier as low as possible. So
yes,
having
a
dedicated space, making that barrier to doing it as low as possible. That sounds great. So to get it to happen on a regular basis, because you're creating a groove of sorts, right? You're making a pathway to make that possible. And mm-hmm. once it's established, it will be easier.
And that's how you'll get the benefits from it. And the reason why you don't do it for very long is because it's very difficult to manage the mind. Again, because that expectation is that, oh, I should be clearing my mind or my mind should be empty. That's not the goal of meditation. The goal is to start to catch when the mind starts to wander. That's actually the success in meditation. When you can start to catch, you start to be able to notice, and then you say, oh, okay, well, I'll come back to the breath or whatever the focal point is, and then you catch it again. And so at first, because you can't do that easily, then that's why you don't want to torture yourself by trying to do that for long periods of time. So just do it short stints, and eventually you'll make the progress. And the theory being that once you can start to catch the thoughts, then you do that on the mat, we say, right?
Yeah.
And we start to be able to establish that skill on the mat. And then it's amazing. We start to do that off the mat too. Like you come up with against a challenging person. And instead of having the quick reaction, the meditation process teaches you to take that split second to stop and say, oh, I choose my reaction. Oh, here are the thoughts that are coming up right now. Maybe I won't vocalize every single one of them.
That's
I can pick
tool.
The best way to handle the situation. And that's that's one of the benefits of meditation.
That's beautiful. I love that. I love that. The catching of the thoughts. You know, I used to make a joke with the kids that had to do with this idea of catching the thoughts, because if you can catch the thought soon enough, right, mm-hmm. then you have a choice. And so if you notice, say, for example, you're having a thought that's maybe negative, then you can flip it. Like you can kind of just pause for a moment and be like, wait, is it really that bad? You know, with the kids, because there's this big yoga word, right? Pratyapakshabhavana, the transformation of negative thoughts to positive thought. I thought it was just like funny because it's such a big word. Like, and when the kids were tiny, it was like, pratyapakshabhavana, you know? And it was, they were all proud they could say it. Like, oh, cool. You know, like, what's mm-hmm. that? You know? But it has to do with like, so in the practice, like the success in the meditation practice is catching the thoughts so that then you can bring it off the mat. And then potentially you might be able to pause and make a better outcome from what might not be the best situation you just happen to be in, right?
Mm-hmm. Right. Yeah, increase your productivity. And also, I believe that the meditation practice is great for stress reduction, because so many things, especially in the world we live in today, there's so much input. I mean, you go to the gas station and there are TVs with ads and whatnot. You go to the pizza place and the news is on. I personally try to stay away from the news because I don't want all that negative input.
Yeah.
You know, they have like 10 stories and 9 of them are negative. Somebody got killed and whatnot.
I know.
And
it's
then only
crazy.
One is the feel good story. If even that, it's probably less than 9 out of 10.
It's very hard to find that balance of being plugged in enough to be informed about what's happening for safety reasons or knowing what to do next, but also disengaging. I'm a big disengager myself. I feel like there's only so much sensory input that is possible to take in before you just, like, I don't know, like you just, brain overloads.
It's so taking,
how to manage the balance there?
It's taking in like mental poison. Oh, and we need, it's important to purge. Mm-hmm. And in the same way, maybe you with the physical, if you haven't been eating well, you do a cleanse. Well, okay. It's important to do that regular mental cleanse as well. And that's what the meditation practice does, is I like to equate it to cleaning out a closet.
Beautiful.
When you do that, you take all the clothes out, you take out all the shoes at the bottom and the papers and whatnot. And maybe you make it all nice. And when you put it back in, then what you do is you say, okay, well, do I really want to put this leather mini skirt that I wore in the 80s back in my closet? Maybe this will go to Goodwill. And that's what happens with the mind too, is when you go to bring the thoughts back in, you become much more selective of what is valid to bring back in.
Beautiful. What serves you now?
Mm-hmm.
Today.
Right. Yeah, because a lot of us, most of us probably, are walking around with old paradigms in our minds.
Wow.
Who we are, and maybe that's not who we are, or who that other person was, or what that situation was. Maybe that situation was helpful at some point, but now it's toxic. Maybe your relationship is like that, or the other way around. You know, talking about second chances. It works both ways.
Both ways. What do you mean both ways?
Well, sometimes something starts healthy and becomes toxic. Sometimes maybe a family member, maybe a parent, the relationship was toxic, and then you maybe push that person away, and then you realize, well, you know what? Time has passed. They've changed. I've changed. Maybe I can forge a relationship back with my dad or something now.
Oh,
you know,
lovely. I love to hear that side of it. I actually went to a lecture not too long ago. It was before everything broke out with the pandemic, but I went to this lecture, and the speaker was telling a story about how he, as a teenager, had this feeling about his dad, I think it was. And he just felt like, he doesn't get me, he doesn't understand me, he doesn't listen. And so many years went by.
Right.
Many years went by. And he had that old paradigm, is it right to say paradigm about that?
Yes.
He had that old image of the way things were stuck in his head. And for many years, he didn't have a relationship with his dad. And he sort of flipped it around. And by now, many years have gone by. But there were a number of years where it wasn't like that anymore. And he didn't get to have the advantage of having that close relationship with his dad like he could have.
Right.
So it was a shame, but at least he caught it when he did.
Mm-hmm.
And he could realize, you know what, things are different now. He's not that angry teenager. His dad is not reacting to him in that way. You know, he's an adult, and things have shifted for the better. So I love the focus on how things can change for the better, and how if we don't look at those things, we might be stuck in an old thought pattern, and how meditation can help with that. That's awesome. Thank you for sharing that, Deb. Oh my God. So we talked a little bit about also the expectation of the results with meditation.
Mm-hmm.
You give us a little more insight on that.
Number one, the goal is not enlightenment, at least not for most of us.
Yeah.
Maybe it is for Dharma, but it's certainly not for me.
Uh-huh.
And I've meditated for a long time, but it's more about, again, being able to organize the thoughts and determining what's valid, what's not valid. It's about stress reduction. Again, I talked about the purge. Those are the things that are realistic goals.
Beautiful. Excellent. Organizing your thoughts, purging old patterns. Sounds good to me.
Where do I start?
I know, right? Sign me up. Now, it's funny because related a little bit to this idea of signing up for something and then having it be a quick fix, it's tricky. What it's bringing up for me is this idea that sometimes we feel like if we just do this, X, Y, Z, then that will kind of flip everything on its head and clear up years of issues and things like that. I wouldn't say that meditation would be like a quick fix and you're going to feel it overnight.
No, not at all.
No, but it's a little bit like brushing your teeth. Like if you do that regular like cleansing, so to speak, that you can maintain good health. And there's so many benefits health-wise.
Right. And it'll take a while just to develop that habit of being able to first even catch the thoughts, mm-hmm. let alone to be able to keep the mind on that one focal point for the entire, say, 3 minutes.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
That's a process in and of itself. And then once you've done that, then you can start to get the benefits of being able to catch when you're having rogue thoughts in your daily life.
Yeah. I love that you said rogue thoughts. Have you ever heard of this book called The Artist's Way?
No, I have not.
It's a great book. So The Artist's Way, I remember this was years ago. I was in an acting group.
Okay.
And this group had a moment where they met outside of acting class, and we all got together and we did this book called The Artist's Way, and we did it in community with each other. And it's set up like a workbook. That's why we were able to do that. And in one of the beginning chapters, it talks about this idea of imagining things in your mind in a cartoonish way. And then they become not so scary. So when you're talking about rogue thoughts, immediately in my mind, I have this image of this little cartoonish, like rogue thought, like kind of caricature. And that makes it not so scary. Like sometimes those thoughts can be like really terrifying.
Absolutely. And especially for people that suffer from panic disorder. That's something that I suffered from for a long time.
Okay.
And it's really, a lot of it is fear-based, and
okay.
where the fear is so much bigger compared to what the situation is.
Wow.
It's disproportionately large, and learning to just to look it in the face and manage it and say, well, I'm just going to the drugstore. And to somebody with panic disorder, that is a huge fear situation, where for other people, well, it's not, I'm just going to the drugstore. What's the big deal? And yeah. It's learning how to put the fear, bring the fear back into proportion.
So interesting. My teen right now, they love this group, Panic at the Disco. It's a little different than panic on your way to the grocery store.
Yes.
But I suffer a little bit from panic on the way to the grocery store. I don't know. Can we come up with a cooler name, like Panic on your way to the bodega, panic at the bodega. So panic at the bodega is a little different than panic at the disco. But I definitely feel like that in this state that we're in with the pandemic, we have a hill on the way down to our grocery store. And literally, as I start to walk down the hill, I physically feel it in my body, that panic come up. And I'm sure I'm not alone.
No,
you know?
No, and then, you're not.
Then there's the whole cleaning frenzy when you get all of the items into your home, you know, like get the disinfectant out, you know, you know, and there's the process with that. So it adds a whole new layer onto this idea of like chop wood, carry water, that is like when you're doing your daily chores, to meditate on that, you know, mm-hmm. like in the cleaning mode, maybe meditate on wiping down the groceries, using it as a tool to help us stay calm when right. There's this heightened sense of panic and this dystopian society. It feels like we're living in a movie that like someone would write and no one would believe would be true, but we're in it.
You're absolutely right about that. And one of the things that meditation also teaches us, well, the general yoga practice does, is being in the present moment.
Okay.
And that's all we have.
Thing. That's it.
Because if you get into the headspace of the past, well, you can't change the past.
No.
And if you start concerning yourself with the future, there's so many different permutations of what could potentially happen in the future that I always like to say that worrying is a useless emotion, because we can't predict what the future is going to bring. I think 9/11 taught us that
wow.
one day a husband went to work and never came back. That changed that wife's life forever, in a way that she never could have anticipated or counted on. And so all we have is this moment.
Yeah. You know what you're reminding me of in that, Deb, is this is another story. There are two people walking together, and one person is worried about what foot they're going to step off the curb on. And the curb is like 20 feet away. And so the idea is that as you're walking, just be in the moment, focus on the steps that you're taking in the moment.
Yes.
And then you won't know what foot you're going to step off that curb with until you're at the curb.
Right.
You just won't know. So mm-hmm. to stay in the moment is a great...
And it's okay to not know.
It's okay to not know, yeah?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Sometimes if we're so... it's one thing to plan, but if we get so involved in planning, then I think we close doors there are things like buying the studio. I never could have imagined that opportunity. And it was such a great thing to have happened in my life. And if I had planned for, I think when you say, oh, I want this to happen, I want that to happen, I want this kind of car and this kind of guy, it's closing off. And maybe there's something better for you that you're not even, that you can't even imagine.
That you can't imagine, right? Yeah.
Yeah, you can't even fathom it.
That's great outlook. I think that's very positive.
Yeah,
right?
Allow yourself to be open. By staying in the present moment, you allow yourself to be open to things that you hadn't even thought of.
Great. Oh, good. Right? Yeah, things sometimes you don't know. Right. I don't know why I'm thinking about thinking outside of the box now. Okay, so here's the story. So there's a man who, his car breaks down on the side of the road, and it's a long stretch of road, and there's a fence. And on the other side of the fence is a psychiatric facility. And so this guy pulls over, his tire is flat, and he goes to start changing the tire, takes off the lug nuts and puts them in the hubcap and puts them down. I guess it's a narrow road. And at some point, a car drives by really fast and hits the hubcap and the bolts go flying. So now he has a tire with the bolts are gone. And so he's just sitting there like, well, now what do I do? And so after a while, he's sitting there and someone from the other side of the fence comes up to the fence and just sits there for a while. They just like look at each other. And then after some time goes by, the guy from the other side of the fence says, well, why don't you take one lug nut off of all of the other tires and put it on that fourth tire until you can drive into town and get another lug nut for each one of the other ones. And the guy, you know, who was driving the car is like, wow, that's pretty insightful. Like, how is it that you knew that? And that the guy on the other side of the fence was just thinking outside the box. You know, there was just, yeah, I don't know. There's something to be said about, you know, the differences in people and the differences in the way we think. And, you know, you have something to learn from everybody. You know,
right.
the guy on the road was not thinking outside of the box, and he wouldn't have. He would have sat there not knowing. Meanwhile, the guy on the other side of the fence that maybe, I don't know if the guy on the road might have been afraid of or, you know, but mm-hmm. he had some great insight. And so how do you...
And the fact that he was open to listening to that insight.
Oh, great. Right?
Because how often are we not?
Yeah.
And maybe we miss those nuggets of wisdom.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. So let's talk a little bit more about staying on track.
Part of the problem is in this world that we're living in today, everything is streak based. And I've talked to a number of people who say, oh, well, I use an app and I had a streak for 100 days and then I missed one day and then I never went back to it. I never meditated again.
So once you fall off of your streak, that's it.
Mm-hmm.
So that's what tends to happen.
Yes. And I think it's important to be conscious of that. And if you stumble, just get back up and start again.
That's great. That's good, right?
Yeah.
So with regard to staying on track, if you fall off of your practice, it doesn't necessarily mean that you should quit altogether. So what would be something that might help bring someone back around? You know, so I actually had a streak going.
Mm-hmm.
I did 108 YouTube videos in 108 days.
Oh, wow.
One for every day of the pandemic. Once we got to the 108th day, I took a pause and I decided, let me focus on the podcast and let me do that. So that's not necessarily falling off a streak.
Was 108 days by design?
108 is an auspicious number, isn't it?
Yes. In both yoga and mathematics.
Oh, in mathematics too. How in mathematics?
Yes. It's called a hyperfactorial. It's 1 to the 1st times 2 to the 2nd times 3 to the 3rd.
Oh my gosh, that's so cool. A hyperfactorial.
Yes.
I didn't know that. And do you know the significance in yoga, the
108?
Yes.
That? It shows up in a lot of different places. Krishna had 108 gopis and things like that. It's all over the place in the scriptures.
Oh, cool. And what's a gopi?
A gopi, well, one of the incarnations that Krishna was he was a cowherd. He was like a cowboy. And the gopis are, you know, when you talk, like you hear, like in mantra, you hear like Gopala and Govinda, that those are all names for Krishna when he was a cowboy.
Oh,
and,
cool.
You know, cows are sacred in Hinduism. The gopis were the cowgirls, and all the cowgirls loved Krishna when he was Govinda.
Oh, fabulous. Okay,
yeah.
Good. Go Krishna's popular guy.
Yep.
Cool. Wow. Cool. You know,
he was the Justin Bieber of his time.
Cool. Awesome. That's fun.
Yeah. But so you were talking about streaks and.
Yeah. So with regard to streaks, we know each other through the Pat Flynn income stream. And
yes.
I got inspired through the income stream to start doing YouTube videos to share our work, working with bodies,
mm-hmm.
teaching yoga, teaching Pilates, teaching fitness with people in the course of the pandemic. So I started doing YouTube videos to translate what I would teach automatically in a live class and share that with students that right now we're not doing live classes. So
mm-hmm.
to share that information. And then it was also giving me a focal point. I think I knew that if I had a system, that if I had a routine, that I'm going to get up, I'm going to make a video, I'm going to, you know, get onto the income stream, which we've been watching every day at 11 o'clock Eastern, right?
Mm-hmm.
Then it kept me in a routine. It kept me with a focal point. It kept me from going to an emotional place that maybe was not going to be as positive. I think the more I felt productive, the better.
You were grounded.
Yeah, it definitely helped be grounded. And it had to be a doing of sorts. If I do this, then I'm physically focused. And I think when you talk about the layers of a person, right, you've talked about the koshas,
mm-hmm.
like the layers of a person. There's the
yep.
physical body, the breath body, the emotional body, the intellectual body, and the bliss body.
Yes.
Like all of the koshas. My yoga mentor, Mukunda Stiles, his platform was structural yoga therapy. And I studied with him. And what he would say with regard to the koshas is that if you imagine the koshas, the layers of a person's body, like I like to think of it like a little gingerbread man shape.
Mm-hmm.
and then another line outside of that, another line outside of that, another line
yes.
outside of that. And those are the layers. But the first layer is Annamaya kosha, which is the physical body, literally
yes.
the physical body made of food.
yeah.
Right? So you are what you eat. So you got to watch what you eat too. That's important. But what Mukunda would say is in all of those layers, if you work in any one layer, the whole thing shifts like a hologram.
Yes.
So
that's so true.
Yeah. So if you can't work in another layer, like if for whatever reason, and he would work with many different people, mm-hmm. so many different people with many different issues. So if you literally, if you couldn't move your body, you could work with the breath.
Right.
You could work with the intellectual body, you know. But I like to think of those tools as different ways you can address your whole being.
Exactly.
So that, yeah.
Because
so
in the same way, if you have trouble tapping into your emotional body, then you could work with the physical body and that might even be in a Hatha Raja situation, and you focus on the physical and the emotional shifts, you know, it begins to loosen, like you said.
Yeah. So if your emotions are kind of like all over the place, like all scattered because of, say, what's happening in the world today, which is probably for a lot of us happening, right?
Yes.
So to be able to focus on one thing. And for me, it was the doing in the moment, like do this. And it just helped me get a little more grounded, right? For another person, it might be go for a run, right? Or we have another colleague mm-hmm. who is counting their steps, and they've also shifted to veganism. And Michael, right? Michael Mann.
So, oh, yes.
Yeah. So we know Michael from the same group.
Mm-hmm.
And so he's made a shift, and he switched to veganism. And also,
oh, I didn't realize that was new, his veganism. Okay. Interesting.
Oh, you know, it's a good question. I think because I haven't known Michael for that long.
Mm-hmm.
I just know that my youngest child is vegan.
Mm-hmm.
And we have that in common, like the veganism. I thought, oh, let me ask Michael for some recipes, you know, like,
yeah.
So I actually don't know how long he's been vegan, but mm-hmm. I do know that I'm very impressed by how many steps he's been taking. He's been reporting once in a while, like how many steps he's taken in a certain time frame. And I'm very impressed. And like,
yeah, it's been a lot.
Wow. It's a lot. So
yeah.
how do you get into that regular habit? How do you get into that regular pattern? And it reminds me of this idea, like So for me, it was like doing the videos on a regular basis. Mm-hmm. For another person, it might be taking a certain number of steps. So maybe there's something about counting the steps. And Deb, you're coming from a math background, like the counting and the numbers, you know, that can be like a neat connection to make. Like, so some people are going to be more connected to numbers, mm-hmm. And some people are not. Even in meditation, I teach a regular online yoga class, and we do actually 20 minutes of meditation in the beginning of class, which is kind of unheard of usually. Mm-hmm. In a live class, it's like, oh, you're not going to spend that much time on meditation. I think that's the case. I could be wrong. But we specifically do 20 minutes of meditation pretty much at the beginning of the practice. Mm-hmm. And I teach a couple of options. We can either do passage meditation. I don't know if you're familiar with Eknath Eswaran. Do you know Eknath Eswaran?
Mm-mm.
So the way I know Eknath Eswaran is that he does passage meditation. And this is a practice where you literally memorize a passage mm-hmm. that is inspirational to you. And he spans all faiths. Like, it's very all-inclusive. His
ecumenical, yeah.
Yes, he's very open. He has a book. I think it's called God Makes the River to Flow. I hope I have the title right. We are all one, even though we're all different. And how can we bring peace to the world if we, you know, we have to find a way that we can just find more peace, feel more connection. And Eknath, I think, does that. Integral Yoga, where I did my first yoga teacher training, their mm-hmm. symbol has all of the different religions in the edges of their logo, and a space for anything we missed out on, you know, like, and in case we missed anything, there's this symbol for like anybody else, right? Because we don't know. Right. But it's all inclusive. This book that Eknath Eswaran has compiled is a collection of a lot of different inspirational passages from a lot of different faiths. Mm-hmm. And so it's a resource, so that even though I'm maybe not one of the faiths that is represented in the book, I might really like that passage, and I might learn it and memorize it, and maybe I'll have a connection to another person from another faith and be able to have a connection there. And it's about like repeating those words as the meditation, and then in the process of speaking in your mind's eye, like silently saying those words, that there's an inspirational aspect as well. So that's the Eknath, that's the Eknath Eswaran passage meditation. So when I teach yoga class, we do a simple short version of like an introduction to that practice.
Mm-hmm.
And we say a few inspirational phrases. Right. So I'll just share you the phrases with you. So the first phrase is in relationship to your own self.
Mm-hmm.
The second phrase is a relationship to the people you're in regular contact with, the people you speak with on the phone, the right. people you see on Zoom calls.
Mm-hmm.
And then the third phrase is in relationship to the world at large.
Mm-hmm.
And so we came up with this few passages a little bit based on Sharon Salzberg as well.
Mm-hmm.
And so the phrases are, the first phrase, may I make a friend of my body.
Mm-hmm.
And that can,
I like it.
Yeah. It can become a useful in many ways.
Yeah.
I have an injury, like that. Am I getting older? Am I going through menopause? Am I, you know, what, mm-hmm. you know? Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I like it. That specific variation on may all beings be happy and free from suffering. Just yes. to make it specific. I love it.
Oh, that's so good. Yeah. Right. Yes. Right. Yes. So the first phrase, may I make a friend of my body? Mm-hmm. The second phrase comes directly from Sharon Salzberg. The second phrase is, may loving kindness manifest throughout my life. And if you imagine the people that you're in contact with on a regular basis. Mm-hmm. And the third phrase is, may we all, you can think of the world, right? Feel connected, supported, and loved.
Nice.
And if we all did, wouldn't the world be a different place?
Absolutely.
Right? So those are the phrases we use in meditation practice. And they sort of just evolved over time, like in talking about Eknath and in talking about Sharon Salzberg and the metta practice and loving kindness. And so we do those. Now, sometimes we'll do the phrases. Sometimes we'll do a numbers practice.
Interesting.
That comes from the Zen Mountain Monastery. So the Mountains and Rivers Order specifically. And what they do there is very specific, very simple counting practice, counting from 1 to 10.
Mm.
So you inhale, at the top of the inhale, you count 1. You exhale, at the bottom of the exhale, you count 2. Inhale 3 and exhale 4 and so on. When you get to 10, you pause and you come back to 1. So it's very simple.
Right.
Now, in class, it's very interesting because some of my students just like love the phrases and really can't relate to the numbers.
Mm-hmm.
Right. But the opposite might be true for different students.
Exactly. Yeah, it's very personal, the meditation. And I think that part of the problem with making the commitment is like some people, when they want it, they struggle to making commitment to exercise because they think that exercise is a certain thing. I have to get out and I have to run. I have to lift weights. When there are so many different kinds of sports that they can do that maybe they would enjoy. And if they find something that they enjoy, they'll stick with it and they'll be able to make that commitment to do it on a regular basis. And that's the same thing with meditation. There's walking meditation. There's, you know, there are all different kinds of mantra, like you said, like the different things that you tell yourself as the thing to the placeholder. I consider mantra to be the placeholder of what's in the forefront of the mind, to push the thoughts to the background. And if you can find what works for you and what you connect with, that's going to help with the commitment.
Wow, that's awesome. I love that. What a great commentary on like kind of what can help you stay on track.
Right? Yes.
Beautiful, beautiful. I wonder, Deb, I would love to know your thoughts on just a couple of tips that you think might be useful and helpful for our listeners to take away with them right away so that they can have a quick win. Like what are a couple of things you think might be useful and helpful?
Okay, I'm going to reiterate about setting the meditation space. Make it very easy to just sit and start. The second thing would be to figure out what interests you, what you find intriguing. Is it walking meditation? Is it sitting? Is it using mantra? What kind of mantra? And it doesn't have to be anything religious based. It doesn't have to be inhale Krishna, exhale Ram. It could be just something as inhale, saying the word inhale in your mind, exhale, saying exhale, or in with the good air, out with the bad air. It could be something, but knowing in advance what works for you, what sings to you.
Oh, beautiful.
Is important. And when you can identify those things, you get to a point where you can look forward to starting this, because then beautiful. When you're doing it, you're going to get the results from it, and then that'll encourage you to continue to do it.
Beautiful. And it's very personalized that way. That's awesome.
It is. And there are so many different options.
Beautiful. Excellent. We had spoken about an insight timer. Do you want to speak a little bit about that?
Yes, it's an app that I personally use to keep myself on track to a daily meditation practice. Now, the thing to know about this personally, I don't feel that meditation are those guided meditations. I think that maybe on a night that you can't sleep and you want to listen to something like that and then it helps you sleep, then that's great. But as far as meditation and doing what we've been talking about, which is clearing the mind so that you can be selective as to what you bring back in to kind of reorganize the snow globe, then I don't feel that that a guided meditation is a way to get those results. But what it does have is it has an actual timer with a gong at the beginning and a gong at the end, and I can set what, you know, the length of meditation that I want. And it helps me keep my practice a little more structured. I don't have to worry that I set a timer on my phone for 3 hours instead of 3 minutes, which I've done. and it's free. There's certainly a paid version of it, but for using it for that purpose, and it's nice to be able to, it shows you other people that have meditated. You can send them a message saying, thank you for meditating with me. And it's again, to feel that connectivity that we have with every other thing in the universe, the entire manifest creation, I like to call it.
Oh, that's awesome. I love that. I love that. So I would love to let our listeners know where they can find you, Deb.
My website is debwertz.com, W-E-R-T-Z. And I'm on social media, on Instagram and Twitter. My username is choose your words, choose_URWORDS.
Beautiful. Oh, I love that. And choosing your words is so important, isn't it?
In the reduction of suffering, it's vital.
Good. Let's have more reduction of suffering, shall we?
Yes, please.
I like that. So I'm so excited for our conversation, Deb. Thank you so much for joining me. I know you had mentioned that you have also a resource for meditation, and maybe we can share the link in the notes. Does that sound good?
Yes, that sounds great.
Beautiful, beautiful. So that can be a good resource for our listeners. And thank you so much for being on the show.
Thank you so much for having me. I had a great time. It was so great connecting with you.
It was great connecting with you too, Deb. We look forward to maybe have another conversation down the road.
I would love that.
Thanks so much. Take care.
You too. Bye-bye.
Bye. I hope you enjoyed this episode as much as I did. Please make sure to check out the show notes for a special download that I made for you that is your meditation toolbox. It's a simple PDF that you can download and have right at your fingertips. I hope this is helpful, and we look forward to seeing you next time. Take care. Thanks. Bye.